No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Kathleen Gomez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008 or Skype us at BBS Radio 1. That's BBS RadioOne. Our guest tonight is Ayelet Hines, a faculty member at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, who is here to discuss DC statehood, advocacy, and how to affect policy and policymakers. This should be an interesting show, so please call in and join the conversation. Again, the number is 888-627-6008. Before I go any further, let me introduce my co-host, Kathleen, who is sweating it out in middle America these days. Hey, Kathleen, you got the air conditioning on?
Oh, my gosh. And people say there's not a difference between humidity and dry weather, right? There's no difference. There is a heck of a lot of difference.
That's what you people from Arizona say.
Oh, my gosh. Not the rest of us. Give me 100 degrees and dry heat any day. It is. I mean, it's been so hot, it's even hard to, like, go out. And the sun just seems so much more intense. I mean, for Kansas, you know, it just feels like it's burning your skin. I expect that from Arizona, but I didn't expect it here in Kansas. But yes, but isn't our weather that I'm experiencing just going to come on to you? Aren't you guys sweating out there too in the East Coast?
Well, the last couple of days have been nice, but in general, yeah, we've had a very hot August, and it's led to some problems here in the District of Columbia, including a skyrocketing murder rate lately. Before we introduce our guests, let me just give you an update on what's going on in statehood. Congress is still out, so nothing's really happening. No new co-sponsors, but we expect to be plugging away this week when they come back into session, and that's some of what we'll ask our guest about. Let me just say to America, for all you working people out there, as a former Teamster, I lied about my age when I was 17 and I got a job as a Teamster truck driver, and always been a union guy. So all you people out there that work for a living and make this the great country it is, I hope you have a great holiday tomorrow, including you, Kathleen.
Oh, gee, thank you. 'Cause
I know you're working hard.
I am working hard. And with that said, let me introduce our guest today, which is Ayelet Hines. She's a faculty associate at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Previous jobs have been the National Democratic Institute, NDI Environmental Defense Fund, I love that group, and M plus R Strategic Services, Inc. And Ayelet Hines went to one of my favorites, the University of Texas at Austin. Great place. How are you doing, Ayelet?
To both of you for having me on your show this evening.
Oh, yeah, thanks. And let me just add to, I'm not sure that Ayelet puts this among her accolades, but she will always have a place in my heart because she was brave enough to go out during a campaign one time and actually pass out literature for me at a polling place. So there's nothing that endears you more than to a person than standing up and working the poll. So it's good to talk to you, Ayelet. It's been too long, and thank you for being on the show.
You bet. I know that you've got a lifetime's worth of fantastic work, and I have so much respect for you. I will hand out your literature at the library any day.
Okay, Don, make sure we got that on tape, okay? Okay, may come in handy in the future. Let me start by asking you, Ayala. Congress comes back next week, and here we are. All of a sudden, we got on a roll a little bit during the recess because of, I don't know if you saw this piece that John Oliver did on his little HBO TV show, but he did a 17-minute piece on DC statehood, and it got 5 million views. So that's huge for us to get 5 million people across America to see the situation that we're in. So when they come back next week, what do we need to do to go after these guys on Capitol Hill to get more co-sponsors for our bill?
So when I think about the campaign for DC statehood, you know, I come to advocacy from the environmental movement, labor, public health, and I've worked on a lot of different issues and have gotten to see how movements develop. And so when I think about the campaign for DC statehood, I think about how can the campaign do for statehood what Mothers Against Drunk Driving did for impaired driving. So for example, they took what would have been an individual's problem, like an individual's responsibility, and turned it into a problem that affects everybody, because anybody could be struck by a drunk driver, and anyone's child could be killed by a drunk driver. So they were masterful in making what would have been an issue of individual responsibility into a problem that affects everyone. Same goes with the tobacco control advocates, who basically did the same thing with environmental exposure to tobacco smoke. So we could talk about an individual's responsibility around smoking cigarettes, and that's a very different conversation from what they turned it into, which was people working at bars and restaurants should not be exposed to smoke from cigarettes. And so they made smoking everybody's problem, even though the health impacts from alcohol and from tobacco generally happen late in life. They generalized the impact across the entire population. So when I think about the campaign for statehood, I think, how can it become everybody's problem?
Well, that's amazing. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head as far as I'm concerned, because that is our major problem, is that, you know, when an African American gets shot in St. Louis, black people all across America feel that. But in D.C., since we're the only ones that are really denied, it really is hard to get other people to feel our pain, because it really doesn't impact them. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that's the crux of the issue right there. How do we get people to feel that the disenfranchisement that we have here in the district somehow affects them? Any ideas?
I think about a couple campaigns in particular, and I believe these were Planned Parenthood-initiated campaigns in South Dakota and in Mississippi, and they were both around reproductive rights. And that organization was dealing with voters who may not have agreed with them on the particular issue of reproductive rights, but they did agree with them on the role of government, and that health care decisions should be between a woman and her doctor and not be made by state. So I'm curious, has there been polling done or any kind of opinion research beyond D.C., and there probably has, this campaign has been going on forever, that has revealed what messages resonate with people outside of the district? Is there some sort of intervention that Congress is doing that people wouldn't want to see happen in their own backyards?
Yes, I think we I think we've seen that, and we certainly it's funny that the John Oliver piece really hit home with a little segment about HIV and the fact that Congress took away a needle exchange program from the district for 10 years until HIV rates became the highest in the District of Columbia, as higher in D.C. than anywhere in the country. And when they allowed us to use our own money eventually after 10 years of taking the money out of the budget, when they allowed us to use it, new cases of HIV dropped by 70%. And they just did this study, it's funny, a few weeks ago, that confirmed that. People at Whitman Walker had always estimated that it had a dramatic impact, but they actually quantified it in a study that was done, I don't know, like 10 days ago, it appeared in the paper, to show that, yeah, actually there was a 70% drop. So we have a couple of those things that I think resonate with people. Let me just finish that. That another problem we have is that 80% of America thinks we have the same rights that they do. So we have a education problem too. I'm sorry, Kathleen, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that I think that you have to find a thing that connects with middle America. You know, one good thing about that I'm traveling, I've been in Arizona, D.C., and Kansas, is that, you know, D.C. is a bubble. And you know, they don't understand, I think, a lot of the politicians, I'm not saying that about Senator Brown, that things don't resonate the same way when you come out here in Kansas. Needle exchange programs are not going to be something people identify. We have to find something that they can connect that's really basic. You know, and I think it's maybe going to war, not having it, losing your child and not being able to have a vote on whether or not, or to elect somebody to vote for war, which is what D.C. happens. I think you have to find really something that really tugs and can be something that everyone could happen, and then that connects. And I think maybe that, I don't know, what do you think, Ayala?
I'm wondering, what are the, say, top three issues that move voters all over the United States, and is there an issue there that, say, D.C. has no say in? Like, important. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I was going to say that in the Post today, they said inequality was one of the top issues they thought nationwide, and certainly that strikes at us. But I think Kathleen's right. I think that we certainly get a lot of play with veterans, you know, out when we talk to veterans groups and we talk about veterans. That seems to play better in Kansas and Arizona and Ohio than needle exchange does. Needle exchange is just kind of a brutal example of how they interfere with our lives, and people actually die from it. But yeah, I think there are other issues out there. And unfortunately, if you know this, Ayala, because you're an advocate, we don't put the resources in it to actually do the studies. But that's probably what we need. We probably need to determine, you know, what those issues are before we move further.
You know, one of my organizing heroes is Vinnie DeMarco. He is a seasoned campaigner based in Baltimore. He's done fantastic work on gun control and alcohol and tobacco, and I really admire his work and his method. And Vinnie, his first step is always opinion research to see what subject will actually get people to change their vote. In his opinion research, he identifies issues that if a policymaker didn't vote his way, that policymaker would lose a substantial number of votes. And if the opinion research shows that people will not change their votes on a particular issue, he basically goes back to the drawing board and doesn't engage in a policy campaign as much as, say, a public education campaign, which I don't know how much even touches those, but he walks away from issues where people will not change their vote over it. And I think the investment in that kind of research, yeah, it's expensive. You might pay $25,000 or $50,000 for it or more, and that sounds expensive, but it's a lot cheaper than losing your campaign.
Well, and we lose $2 billion. We estimate that we lose $2 billion a year by not being a state. And, you know, but we have a hard time convincing people in the Wilson building, members of the city council, that this is worth something investing in. But yeah, it seems to me Puerto Rico invests $20 million in its effort to become a state, and we invest about $200,000 a year. So it seems to me that we need to invest a lot more money, and that's probably one of the best ways to spend the first $50,000 is to do the research.
Let me ask you something. I mean, I remember in the days when I was, you know, in school and we were learning politics 101 and stuff like that, but there has to become like a critical mass, right, among the population that can change, that they have to somehow move together, and then it creates a critical mass for the change to happen. And that's the issue, isn't it, to find what can bring everyone together enough to figure out it's worth fighting for.
You don't need everyone to agree with you. You need just enough people.
Right.
So it's possible, playing an inside game, that you get your target decision makers to say yes to you. And you need to back that up with some grassroots support, too, so that policymakers who are sticking their necks out for you can point to support from their voters, that at least a good number of them, it doesn't have to be all of them or even most of them, support your campaign. So successful campaigns have some aspects of grass tops organizing. So by grass tops, I mean engaging people who already have influence over your target decision maker, and grassroots organizing. And depending on your issue, you'll need some amount of both. There's no precise formula. But I don't know. So critical mass, I don't know that you even need that. I think that you could get this done without that.
That'd be great.
Let me correct something that's been said. Kathleen, when you were in college, it was politics one.
You've always
they hadn't gotten to 101 yet.
Hey, listen.
So
listen, Linda. Have you ever seen that thing? Listen, yeah. Linda. Oh, a little Mexican kid. You've always gotta try to pretend you're younger than me, but that's okay. But I wanted to ask you also about this. What are the top four rookie advocacy mistakes that are made in a campaign?
Sure. Well, so I'd say that the one of the top four rookie mistakes in a campaign is confusing a problem with an issue. So, for example, take climate change. You want to do something about climate change. That's a huge, possibly unmanageable problem without a clear solution or way forward. So what organizers do is they cut a smaller, winnable, more manageable piece out of a big problem like that. So but an issue within climate change could be shutting down the dirtiest coal-fired power plants in a particular area. So there you have a clear decision maker. You know what needs to get done. Maybe you have to revoke a permit. Well, who's in charge of that? Who can give you what you want there? So confusing a problem with an issue is a place that some advocates get lost. I'd say Another rookie mistake in organizing is going for quick wins without gaining broad public support. And that's something that I just mentioned, which is even if you know, like, really key influencers and can get your target policymakers to say yes to you quickly, you still need to backfill with grassroots support, because that policymaker needs the political cover that grassroots supporters provide. That policymaker needs to be able to point to voters in districts and say, hey, these people are like, they're really squeaky wheel, and I'm going to give them what they want. So don't think that you can, like, if you go for a quick win because you have those connections, it's going to be a hard win to protect. Okay. Third, I think that sometimes organizers focus on big national issues, which in this political climate are even tougher campaigns than they've been in decades, when they could instead win more easily at the local, state, or county level, where politics aren't quite as polarized often, and people have to live with each other. You know, you've got people on city councils who don't, you know, like, run off to their opposite corners of the country. They actually are neighbors, and they work together in the same community, so they are typically more civil with one another than Congress is these days. And then also not focusing on specific decision makers. So rookie organizers may focus on an entire governing body, an entire city council, an entire state legislature. Your target decision makers are specific people. They are individuals. They are not groups. They are not companies. They are people with names. And each person, like each of those target decision makers, is going to have his or her own motivation, and you need to learn what that motivation is, and that's where you need to begin your conversations with them.
Well, let me ask you, I was going to ask you this question, since you bring that up. What exactly is power mapping? I assume that when you use the term power mapping, you're talking about finding the people that make the decision that you need to influence. Is that right?
Yeah, so a power map is a constellation of names of individuals around your target decision maker, around the person who can give you what you want. And those people can be friends or family or senior staff members or fellow board members or people who went to the same university or someone's pastor at the church. So it's someone who your target decision maker is already likely to trust. And you'd be surprised in your community and with people you have access to already, there are not that many degrees of separation between you and the people on your campaign and the people who your target decision maker already trusts. So a power map sort of it analyzes who holds the power and how do you reach those people through trusted voices. So while you may be very versed on your campaign and you know all of your factoids, you often are not the best messenger for your campaign. And someone who may be a better messenger than you is someone who already has a relationship with that target decision maker. It could be someone like the leadership in someone's political party. It could be a former employer or employee. So it's always worth writing out a power map and determining who's going to have what conversations with what people by when.
Well, and that's probably particularly important in the District of Columbia because we have so many people here that are connected in all those ways you mentioned, friends, family, colleagues, went to the same university. It's amazing the diverse group of people we have in Washington. So that's probably really, really important to us, and we should do more of that sort of thing. Can you tell me, we've read, Kathleen and I have both been reading the stuff that you've posted, and I find it very interesting. What exactly is Change University, where you're posting this stuff? It's interesting. Explain to people what it is, and maybe we can get them to go on and look at some of your stuff.
Right. So Change University is online training in core democracy skills, in these advocacy skills. So there's really no one place you can go to online and learn and learn everything you need to know about how to work for justice. For 25 years, you've been able to go online and learn how to maximize corporate profits by getting an online MBA, but there's no comparable place you can go online at your own convenience at lower cost to learn how to make the world a better place through social change. So I piloted the first course on grass tops organizing. It's an hour-long, fully interactive course, and I shot that around to different organizations, and Johns Hopkins University, Bloomberg School of Public Health asked me to develop the next 24 hours of online curriculum for them, and I did that, and I've, for the past 2.5 years, I've been teaching mostly physicians who are getting their master in public health. I've been teaching them how to change the system. They come to the university because they're trying to make people well in a broken system, and they want to learn how to change that system. So I teach them that through an online course. So were you going to say something?
I was just going to say, does it cost anything for people to enroll in this? Or is this a free service, Change University?
It's not a free service. It is a paid service, but it is more economical than in-person training. So I can't tell you how many times I've been part of trainings where you fly people over the country, you put them up in hotels, you feed them at restaurants, you bring in trainers, and $40,000 later, you've trained 8 people. And that's great if you can do it. Most organizations can't. You know, most advocates and change makers in the world will never be in that room. So how do we democratize democracy here? How do we democratize training in that skill set? Well, we do what the corporate sector has been doing for decades. We do what the government's been doing, what academia has been doing, and we move that training online. And right now, no one's really doing that. So I am bringing that to the market so that advocacy training can be available anytime, anywhere, for lower cost and be more comprehensive than anything else that's out there. And
well, it seems like a great idea to me. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, imagine, like, even if you're a trainer, right? So maybe you do these in-person trainings. Imagine if you walked into a room full of people who got trained on their own time and walked into the room with the same basic level of understanding about advocacy. They knew the term, they knew the concept. It's what people in the educational technology space call flipping the classroom. So instead of spending your in-person time defining terms and walking people through concepts and definitions, like the real rote stuff that doesn't really change, have people learn that on their own time or at their own convenience and sit down together, spend that time solving problems and hammering out campaign plans, doing activities that are higher value than walking through, like, here's what a press release is and here's what a campaign plan is. People can learn that on their own, and every other sector seems to be doing that except for the nonprofit sector, which worries me, and so that is a gap that I'm filling.
Wow. Well, I got to tell you that I was involved in exactly what you're talking about. That's how I ended up in Minnesota campaigning with you. This is where Ayala and I met. We met on the Kerry campaign working in Minnesota in Indian country. And I was there because I worked with a group called Indians List who did exactly that. They brought people together and trained Native American candidates. And they were very, very successful. I think out of like 40 candidates, they got almost 30 of them elected. But unfortunately, the organization doesn't exist anymore because it was, as you pointed out, it was too expensive to maintain. And they just couldn't get enough funding, even though we had a couple of these like week-long trainings for candidates, which were great. Unfortunately, the organization, as successful as it was, has gone by the wayside because nobody could afford to continue to fund it. And in addition to that, we did also exactly what you said. We said, this is a post office box. This is a petition to get signatures to get on the ballot. This is stuff that they could have been taught online. The nuts and bolts. And we probably would have been even more productive if they'd come with that knowledge already. So I think what you're doing is an amazing thing. And, I'm sure you'll be very successful at it. And we really need it on the liberal side of things. Right, Kathleen?
Well, yes, but let me ask you another thing that you, if you don't mind going over, and maybe we could talk about how it could apply to the statehood cause, is this, which I had never heard about, the Ten Commandments of Advocacy?
Sure. Well, you may have never heard of it because I wrote it.
Well, there you go.
As much as I'd like to think this is part of the Old Testament, it's not. So these are the just 10 basic principles that I think organizers should follow. So the first is start simple and get fancy later. There have been many successful campaigns that started and ended around kitchen tables by volunteers with no budgets. So start where you are with what you have, even if it's just on your block, and you'd be surprised what you get done. Money follows action, so don't wait for the money. Take action first. The second is know how policies are made and work to improve them. So if you want long-term, durable, enforceable change, you've got to change policies. Public education is not enough, right? So for 30 years, there have been public health campaigns about how we need to walk more and lose weight, and exercise will cure what ails you. And right, so we all know that, and we're fatter than we've ever been, right? So public education campaigns aren't enough. You've got to change policy. And what changing policy does is it makes the default choice the right choice. So I don't have to convince you to drink clean water instead of drinking contaminated water, because you only have clean water to drink. Why? Because it's the law. Because public health advocates made it the law. So that you don't have to depend upon people's will and whims and knowledge to make the right choice. The default decision is the right choice, and that happens through policy. So policy change looks pretty similar at all levels of government. Get to know whichever level of government is most accessible to you, and the other ones will make sense should you start working at other levels of government. You need to have a call to action. So that's number three. Have a call to action. Ask people to do things for you. So sometimes when people ask me, what do you do for a living? I say, I ask people to do things. Will you make a phone call? Will you come to my meeting? Will you sign my letter? Right? So you have to have a clear request of people, whether it's a grassroots supporter or it's a member of Congress. Tell people how to help you. The fourth commandment, you got to talk and listen to people. So you might be really smart and you might know a lot about an issue, but you got to surround yourself with people who are smarter than you and people who are honest. And you've got to also be sure that you are talking to potential supporters about things that they care about and things they think should be done about the problem. You can't march into a community that is new to you and say, here's your problem and here's how I think you should fix it. People aren't going to sign up for that. The fifth commandment is you got to be flexible. So you're going to write a campaign plan, but that is a living document, and it's going to change, and you need to be prepared. You know, your champion policymaker, like your bill's original sponsor, might lose an election, and then what do you do? The Sixth Commandment is don't get distracted. There's always going to be something else to work on. You got to stick to your original vision and don't get sidetracked, while at the same time having that flexibility I mentioned before. You need to base your campaign on solid data. So you need to have bulletproof evidence that tells you how big the problem is, who's affected by that problem. What data tells you is that a problem is not random, and the problem can be solved by taking a specific action in a specific place. So solid data, like, you need that to win your campaign, but that's not going to be why you win, right? Because you're going to win by appealing to people's emotions, not to their love of statistics. The Eighth Commandment, you should always seek new skills. You should always be looking to improve what you do and getting new skills for yourself, not just for now, but for what's next for you. Ninth Commandment is write down your plan. This is not something to keep in your head. You write it down to create some institutional knowledge that you have some document that you can revisit, and you can, if you don't have a map, you don't know how to get where you're going. So your campaign plan is your map. You should revisit it about 4 times a year to update it. In it, you have everything from what your big problem is, what your winnable issue is, what your organizational strengths and weaknesses are, what your organization's goals are, like in terms of new members or money or how many new relationships you want to build with policymakers or with members of the media. You have you list out who your allies are and your opponents, and who are people and organizations that should be allies even if they haven't really signed up. You have your strategy. So are you going to be moving legislation, or are you going to be taking this battle to the courts? You know, what's your strategy? You list out your targets. Your primary targets are the people who can give you what you want. Those are the people you need to, they need to say yes to you. And your secondary targets are the people who influence your primary targets. And you also list out your public audiences and constituencies, like, who are the big groups of people that your primary targets answer to? You need to know what resources you have and what resources you need, and what your tactics are. Like, what specific actions are you going to do to your target decision makers that are really going to move the needle? And who's going to do what by when? Write that all down. There's no way you can just have some idea in your head about that. This is a document. And then, you really, lastly, look at your campaign through your audience's eyes, not just your own, right? And so your audience includes policymakers, voters, supporters, the media, and you need to know what they value. You need to speak to their values, right? So people do things for their reasons, not for your reasons. What are their reasons?
Well, I think that... I got to tell you, I think that this is really great stuff, because what I see as an advocate all the time is that we go off and we do these things without really putting enough thought into exactly what we're doing. We go in and something happens, something happens that affects our issue, and we say, let's all get together and have a rally in front of the Capitol, or whatever the situation is, we're reactive. And I think that's one of our big problems, is that we react too much and we don't plan enough. So I really think this is great stuff.
And as someone who's been involved with your statehood stuff on the kind of the side, not within D.C., you know, you guys have lots of meetings. You meet, and then you meet again, and you forgot what you met on the first time, so you meet again, and then you're going to have another meeting to discuss what you forgot. I mean, it's amazing. I've been to a lot of just meetings, and that's the thing maybe that is difficult. Let me ask you another question. How do you get, you know, in every cause you have a core group of people who have been there forever, who may have started the cause, who may be seen as, you know, a member of this cause forever, and you don't want to, you know, upset these people's feelings, but they become a hindrance, and that they say, oh, no, you can't do that. We tried that, and it didn't work. Oh, no, I don't think you shouldn't do that. And instead of being open-minded to changes in our environment and the way things that people are doing it and the social media and this and that, you know, they get stuck. And they're seen as maybe the core group, or they're seen as the people who started this. So how would you advise people who are coming into a cause to, and those who have been in a cause for a long time, to be able to work together? Because sometimes that's a big problem.
You know, that makes me think of the conversation that happened between the Black Lives Matter activist and Hillary Clinton. So you have this woman who has given her life to civil rights and social change. And then you've got these younger, like by 30 years, activists who see some real problems and see some things that really have to, that really need fixing now. And reconciling, like, the generational differences, I think is some serious work that we have to do in our campaigns, because I think they're both right. You know, you've got these veteran activists, like, they're right, and they've seen what works and what doesn't work. But then you've got this young energy and people who see how the problem affects their lives today, and they have new ideas and they have new tools. And so I think there's some soul searching that needs to happen just across the generations that are coming together working on these really important issues. So I don't know that there's any magical way. I think that if there's any way to reconcile those differences, it's going to happen in, you know, through compassionate conversations like we have with anybody, hopefully. But I definitely acknowledge that those divides do exist. Now, if you've got some old guard that's really not going to budge, maybe there's room to go and do your own work without them. Maybe if they don't want to be brought along, maybe you don't bring them along. But I think it would be arrogant to discard their experience. I mean, there are reasons that they say, well, we tried this and it didn't work. Well, maybe we need to do a better job of compelling them to come over to our side in a different way of thinking and moving them along with us.
Well, you know, it's funny that you should say it that way, because this is a conversation that Kathleen and I had, and this was a while back, and this was Kathleen's position exactly about all the meetings, you know, that we because we see, I think the both of us see the fact that there's meeting after meeting after meeting is just a way to defer action on some levels by the old guard. And I think Kathleen, you know, in terms of statehood, Kathleen was my campaign manager. And I think in terms of the statehood campaign, we've decided that, yes, we can't shut these people out. We must listen to these people. But then again, we must go our own way. And I think that, you know, we're seeing this on the national political scene when we see how well Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. I'm embarrassed by Donald, you know, that Donald Trump is doing so well, and I think a lot of Americans are. But I think it reflects this struggle between the old guard and the new guard. And I think we do have to reconcile it. I'm not exactly sure how we do it, other than what you suggested. You know, this very show is an attempt to try to get people to listen to each other so we can bring them together. But it's a tough problem, and we see it every day here. Let me ask you, Ayala, what are the issues that are important to you? We like to give our guests a forum to talk about what they want to do. What particular issues are you working on these days?
Well, I continue to work on public health issues through the university, through Johns Hopkins. And there are so many issues I care about, and life is so short. And so, honestly, my issue now is helping create more competent activists to carry on the fight beyond my time here. So that's why I am interviewing the best organizers I know. I'm putting that into that's in an online curriculum. I'm giving away everything I've learned over the past 25 years, not just what I've learned, what people I respect most have learned. I'm taking other people's best content, and they are reviewing this stuff and helping me push this stuff out for free. I want to direct your listeners to 3 free guides that I offer. There's the 11 proven steps to designing and winning campaigns. That's like your campaign planning essentials, and you can get that at change-university/win. There's laser focus on power. So that is the 10 steps of power mapping, the questions to ask, and where to find answers. And it's a really easy reference guide for staff, volunteers, and trainers. If you sign up at change-university/win, I will send you all 3 of these, right? And the 3rd is power up and amplify, turbocharge your campaign through coalition. So I teach you what coalitions do, who to recruit, how to pick the best coalition name, how to attract diverse coalition partners, and the leadership and structure of coalitions. So what issue is the most important to me? We need more trained advocates. That's my issue. And so that is what I'm giving myself to these days.
Well, I agree with you. And can people now, I'm sorry, did I miss the website that people go to? Where do people go to get this information?
If you go to change-university.com/win, okay, and you click where it says click here to get the guide, that's where you give me your email address, and I send you that guide, and I will make sure that you also get the other 2 guides. So if you give me your email address through change-university.com/win, I will make sure that you get every guide that I make, and that's just the 1st of 3. I have more in the pipeline. I just finished writing one, like everything you need to know and do and think about for a lobby day or a lobby week, right? So you're going to get your people together, and you're going to go to Congress, you're going to go to city council, or you're going to go to the state legislature or county council and make your case. How do you plan that kind of event? And I'll send that to you. Everything I make is yours for free.
Wow. Well, that's great. And Kathleen, who's had a very successful lobby days in Albany when she was an education advocate in New York City, knows how important that stuff is. We spend a lot of time as local advocates. I mean, we don't anymore because I've been doing this particular issue for the past 9 years. But in the beginning, we reinvented the wheel many times, depending on who was in the room. And the level of expertise that we had access to was also dependent on who showed up for the meeting. So it's great that there's a place, centralized place, where people can go for this kind of information.
Because, I'm sorry, Senator Brown.
No, go ahead.
I was just saying that, my whole stick has been that, to make the change needed in the United States is not going to be, yes, it's the president and the senators and congressmen, but it's really got to be the judges and the
you know, the county supervisors and your council and your school board members, because and doing this, being able to give people, like, you know, I was in a rural area, small town Douglas on the Mexican border, and we had all kinds of very big issues addressing us in a small town, drugs, you know, immigration issues, security issues, and trying to organize people and get them skills or to understand was just, it is, it was very, very difficult to have them come to the meeting or whatever, but your type of thing where people could do it at home when they're relaxed, they don't have to, you know, if they're tired all day, then try to make a meeting to learn how to be an advocate. I mean, this is great, and it'd be great to see a whole slew of grassroots organizers who've been able to use your tools, and I mean, it could be amazing what you could do.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And if there are any listeners out there who want to help me get these tools into the hands of organizations that are working on issues that you care about, please get in touch with me.
Perfect.
Yeah. Is there a way people can contribute to your cause?
Well, let's see. You can let me train your staff, either in person or online, like staff, volunteers, trainers, right? So I will train you and your team in person. I will train you online. I can develop customized online training, right? So if you take the best training and you automate it, it can be customized to any language, any issue, any political context, any branding, right? So if you work with an organization that is particular about branding or works in different languages, let me know. That's not hard to do. So, yeah, how people can contribute to this is use it.
Great. And I encourage listeners out there to do exactly that. Kathleen, do you have anything else to add? We're closing in on our the end of our show here, so
do I have anything to add? Well, you know, no, I just think that it's just a really great thing that you're doing, and I mean, that's one exciting thing about the internet is that everyone can have access to it, even in the most rural areas. And sometimes those rural areas are where people are the most, you know, energetic about, because they see that the change has to happen within, you know, whatever's impacting them. I just think it's great what you're doing, and I hope that we can help you spread the word and people can go to your organization and get to, you know, a lot of people don't realize that it does take some effort. It's a strategy. It's there are proven ways in which you can get people involved, and this is just great. So we'll be sure to help you spread what you're doing, the word around what you're doing, so that, you know, people can be more educated and be more, have more of an impact on their, you know, their government and their local lives in their hometown, wherever it may be.
Well, you know, I just add to that, you know, the work that I did with Indians List, where we got so many people elected. Training is very, very important. I mean, we had, you may remember this, Ayala, from working out of Bemidji with Native Americans, but these people are very often reserved, and they have their own system of government on the reservation. So when it comes to interacting with the people that really change their lives, like school boards and county councils, they're not used to it. It really doesn't fit their kind of, you know, how they do things socially. So, you know, we had people that came out with a stump speech. We had a woman running for Congress, and she basically stood up and said, "Hi, my name is Diane, and I want to run for Congress because I want to change my community." And she sat down. But at the end of a week of training, she gave a stump speech about how her son had served in Afghanistan, was seriously wounded, why she wanted to do things for him. And I mean, there wasn't a dry eye in the place, and she got a standing ovation. So, you know, just bring in the stuff that's already there out of people, so that they can use it in an effective way. I mean, it's such so important, and I agree with Kathleen. The work you're doing is so important, and we thank you for it, because we're two of the old guard advocates. We've been around for a very long time. I think you and I, Kathleen, weren't we at the rally where the first Ten Commandments
was actually introduced? You keep on dragging me down this old people's route, and it ain't happening. I'm not going down there.
Yeah, we met on our first campaign. I was 26, and you were 7. But anyway, thanks so much, Ayelet, for being with us today. We hope you'll come back again sometime. We had a song that we were going to play in your honor when we took our break, but you were so interesting that we didn't take a break. So we'll ask Don to play it on as we exit tonight, and that's a song by the king of protest music, Pete Seeger. So thank you, America. Thank you, Ayelet Hines.
Thank you,
too,
both. You do great work.
And,
thank you so much.
And we hope to talk to you again soon. Here's an oldie but a goodie from Pete Seeger. Which side are you on? See you next week, America.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? They say in Harlan County there are no neutrals there.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.